You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at cvillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at cvillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up today. I'm Dan Gould. Regular listeners of our podcasts might know Rick Britton. He's an historian and cartographer and a frequent guest on WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Rick also designs and hosts Virginia history programs for the Charlottesville Senior Center. In the fall of 2010, the Senior Center offered one of Rick's programs entitled Virginia History 101, running from October 7th through November 18th. This six-part lecture series was designed for those interested in Virginia's fascinating early history. The lecture for November 11th, Jeffersonian Architecture, was presented by Ed Lay. Mr. Lay is the Cary D. Langhorne Professor Emeritus of Architecture at the University of Virginia. A veritable font of architectural knowledge on the Old Dominion, Professor Lay has also taught abroad in Edinburgh and Vicenza. After a brief description of the differences between Georgian and Jefferson period architecture, Lay familiarizes the audience with the many structures designed by our third president, Thomas Jefferson, who introduced neoclassicism to the United States. This is the sixth and final part for this series for 2010. Here's Ed Lay.
Thank you, Rick. I made up all that stuff and gave it to him. So don't believe any of it. At any rate, it's so nice to see so many people here who I know from other occasions, such as the Civil War group, several from that, and I've been on that Civil War group a couple times and love it. And in addition to that, several people who are in my mountain hiking group are here. And then, of course, there are my very, very best students ever from my seminars are here, too. And I know, and I really know, that all of them have stayed up all night on Wikipedia looking up very esoteric and piercing questions that they're going to attack me with here at the end of this. So at any rate, tonight then, what I'd like to do is I'm going to cover... Can you hear me? I'm going to cover the architecture of the Jefferson period in Virginia, 1780 to 1830, also known as the Federal period or the Roman Revival period, especially in Jefferson terms. But first, before we show you any images, I'd like to describe the Georgian period, which preceded this Jeffersonian period, so you have a bit of context. The typical Georgian house, for instance, is like those great James River plantations that you'll be visiting with Rick. And those plantations were basically, two stories in height, double pile, P-I-L-E, meaning two rooms front to back of the house, on either side of a center passage, and the center passage went from the front of the house all the way to the back of the house, and in that passage was the stair to the private bed chambers. That is going to change radically in the period we're going to be talking about tonight, the Jeffersonian period. Okay. Also, first, I'd like to give you some general characteristics of this Jeffersonian period. British pattern books, and pattern books were books that builders and architects used to design things, British pattern books were used in the Georgian period. The first publication in America of a British pattern book was The British Architect by Abraham Swan in 1775 in Philadelphia. But now, American pattern books come into vogue in this period. The first was The Country Builder's Assistant by Asher Benjamin in 1799. We now also have professionally trained architects, the first being Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who was trained in Europe, and the first natively trained was Robert Mills, who studied under both Latrobe and also under Jefferson. Now, in the house itself, the entrance passage now in this Jeffersonian period is no longer continuous through the house from the front to the back, as it was in the Georgian period, But now one arrives at a receiving place or an entry space, often unheated, behind which was a private salon or drawing room. Think of Monticello. Okay. The stairs are no longer in the center passage, but off to the side. And all this results in a greater planned separation of what is public and what is private in those two realms. Fireplaces now have what we call attenuated mantel shelves, often with colonnettes. Ornamental detail now includes interior trim with asymmetrical moldings, cyma curves, adamesque details such as circular and oval patera, garlands or swags, elaborate plaster ceilings and ornaments, graining, marbleizing, reeding, fluting, interlaces, floral, and wave motifs. These characteristics are probably foreign to you, but might become more evident as we show the images a little later. Any questions first before we start? No piercing question. Okay. I'll just say a few more words, but that's all right, before you put on the first slide. Now, what I'm going to do is I'll first discuss public buildings in the federal period or Jeffersonian period, and then I'll talk about dwellings or houses. But first, a few words about Jefferson himself. Jefferson was born on the 13th of April, 1743, and died on the 4th of July, 1826, as probably all of you already know. He was a lawyer, a colonial legislator, a revolutionary leader, governor of Virginia, diplomat, secretary of state, vice president, president, an architect, a landscape architect, to name just a few of his activities. He spoke five languages and read in seven, including Greek and Latin. He accumulated three libraries. The largest was almost 7,000 volumes. And our knowledge of Jefferson is enriched by 65,000 documents, of which there are 19,000 letters that he personally wrote, along with 600 of his personal drawings. So we have a lot of information on him. Jefferson also had 400 slaves during his lifetime. Now, we'll go to the next. This is my slide person here. So if anything goes wrong. Okay. All right. What one thing, maybe this is a good question for you, what one thing makes Jefferson so important as an architect? What one building in America? Do any of you know what that building is? The Rotunda? No. What?
Library of Congress.
No. The Capitol in Richmond. It's on the screen to help you. Because of this particular building, he is known as the father of neoclassicism or Roman Revival in America. What building, this is the Capitol in Richmond, what building was this copied after? What building did he use for his model? The Maison Carré in Nîmes, France. And it was the very first building to be modeled after an ancient Roman temple, making it then the start of the federal period or neoclassicism in America. And because it was a state capital, it was used over and over again in other instances in capitals, classicism. In fact, Jefferson said of the Maison Carré, he said, quote, "Here I am gazing whole hours at the Maison Carré like a lover at his mistress." You've probably heard that, unquote. It even preceded the Madeleine in Paris of about 1806, which was the very first Roman, European Roman temple reproduction in the world. So he was very much ahead of his time, even ahead of Europe. Jefferson had replaced Benjamin Franklin as minister to France and was also Secretary of State from 1784 to 1789 while this capital was being built. It has a tetrastyle, excuse me. There were earlier classical examples in America, such as Peter Harrison's Redwood Library in New England of about 1750, but that was not copied after ancient Roman buildings. It was not really of the very finer classical system. Okay, next. The capital had moved from Williamsburg to Richmond in 1780, and a man by the name of Clarisseau, who had taught the Adam brothers, who were architects in England, Clarisseau then built this model for Jefferson of the Maison Carrée for this his use here in the Capitol in Richmond. Next. Now some federal courthouses. Next. Jefferson designed three courthouses which in Virginia, which became the federal period courthouse prototype. The tetrastyle, meaning four columns across the front, or temple-style courthouse. Shown here is the Charlotte County Courthouse of 1821. Next. He also designed the Buckingham County Courthouse that same year with builder Dabney Cosby. It burned in 1869, but was rebuilt. He also designed the Botetourt County Courthouse in 1818, and it burned in 1847. Cosby, by the way, was one of the many craftsmen Jefferson had brought to this area to work at Monticello and the University of Virginia. Next. Now, the University of Virginia. Next. Jefferson's masterpiece is the University of Virginia, designed between 1817 and 1826, from the time he was age 76 until he died at age 83. He called it the hobby of my old age, and he also referred to it as his academical village based upon the illimitable freedom of the human mind. In the bicentennial year, 1976, about 50 leading architects were asked, what are the most significant buildings in America? And these were contemporary architects. And of the 200 buildings that they listed, the University of Virginia was listed as number one, the, quote, proudest achievement of American architecture in the past 200 years, unquote. This is why the university is so important, far more important than Monticello and other things that most people go to. Very few people coming here go to the university, but it is far more and far more complex and far more interesting than any other Jefferson work. Okay. It is on the World Heritage List, as you probably know, as is Monticello, along with such monuments as the Pyramids of Egypt and the Great Wall of China. So right here in your backyard, you have two places that are on the World Heritage List. Extraordinary. Who have not yet toured the lawn with a touring group? Wow. Not yet. Most people have. Okay. Well, you can see it differently depending on who gives the tour. This then is the, on the screen, is the 1856 lithograph showing Robert Mills' Rotunda Annex built just 3 years earlier. This part here. Mills, America's first natively trained architect, built the Washington Monument, for instance, in the U.S. Treasury in D.C. and Monumental Church in Richmond, among many other buildings. The annex then burned in 1895 from an electrical fire. Then the leading architect of the day, Stanford White, of the famous firm McKim Mead & White, was retained to renovate the rotunda and add extra classroom space at the south end of the lawn. The lawn was situated on a hill with an open end to the south to convey Jefferson's concept of education open to the world. Down here. White had left out a floor on the interior of the rotunda when he renovated it so that the dome room became a story higher. How many of you remember that when it was a story higher? Just one person, okay. Not too long ago it was changed, okay. Although White has been criticized for closing off the lawn at the end, he actually had two concepts, as most architects do. One was placing all the new buildings on an axis to the east, but the one chosen by the Board of Visitors was the one that was built. Our Board of Visitors at the university doesn't always have some of the best decisions that they make, unfortunately. I can say that now because they can't fire me anymore. In the bicentennial year, 1976, the interior then of the rotunda was restored to the original Jefferson space. White also designed the University President's House, but died before its completion. You see here in the foreground, anatomical hall, which was a unique building with a theater basically in the round to allow students to observe medical dissections. The interior was octagonal, actually, with storage for cadaver parts in the angular spaces. Unfortunately, it was raised in 1937 to make way for Alderman Library, which I think you can see in no way impinged on the site. Alderman Library's way over here, way over here. It didn't interfere with it all, but they tore it down anyway. Again, the Board of Visitors making not the best decision. you are looking now towards the east. Where you see the first mountains anyone encountered coming all the way from Richmond. If you're ever up at Monticello, look east and you'll see it's flat as a pancake. Therefore, the first land patents in this area were just east of those mountains around the Keswick area. Also, Monticello was built on top of the mountain, and Jefferson's birthplace, Shadwell, in the little Rivanna River gap between the mountains. Okay. This is the 1825 version of the 1822 Maverick plan of the university showing numbered student rooms. At the north top is the rotunda with its rectangular colonnaded lawn below. That's called the lawn, of course. Most of you know these terminologies, but a few of you might not, so I'll just mention them. On either side of the lawn, then, are five pavilions, where the five pavilions, behind which are the gardens on each side, and beyond which are the arcaded ranges. What makes the lawn so vital, by the way, is the most significant grouping of buildings in America? Do you know? It's something we talk about. I teach modern architecture also. In modern architecture, we talk about the same things. As with Monticello, Jefferson's university and lawn are studies in what we call the contradictions and inconsistencies that so enrich all architecture. Although the academical village appears to be symmetrical, like all Jefferson's work appears to be symmetrical, it is not. It is a subtle study in asymmetry. For instance, I could go on for a whole hour talking about this one subject, but we won't be able to do that. But I'll just give you a couple. For instance, two of the 10 pavilions, plans or facades are alike. They're all very different. Next. The east and west ranges behind the gardens, with student rooms between their hotels, each have an all-weather passage composed of brick arcades. But one-story Tuscan colonnades on each side of the lawn serve the same purpose as you see here. The colonnade passages on each side of the lawn were connected at the rotunda by two below-level all-weather wings lighted with lunettes, right up in here, as you know. These spaces formed the gymnasia, in Jefferson terms, because he expected people to exercise. So if you ever walk through there, you better be exercising, or Jefferson is watching you. Next. The lower lawn level of each pavilion, these are the pavilions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The lower level of each pavilion contained classrooms and sometimes an office. The land then sloped off enough to the rear of the pavilion to allow direct entrance to the ground floor kitchen and sometimes a dining room. The roofs of the lawn colonnades, edged with wooden Chinese railings, were used by professors as private exterior passages linking the second floors of the pavilions where the professors lived. So up here you could walk from one to the other because the professor lived up above. So again, it is a distinction between the realms of public and private, making a big distinction between that of the students and the professors. The roofs were constructed on here in a manner similar to those on the Monticello terraces to form V-shaped conductors of rainwater to gutters and eventually to cisterns. Several of the pavilions had balconies hung with wrought iron rods so they would not engage the columns, which Jefferson did not want them to do. They're set back from the columns themselves. This was believed to be the first use of suspended balconies in America. They have now been replaced, unfortunately, Board of Visitors again, with stainless steel rods. There was a reason for that, but we won't go into it. Next. In most colleges of the day, especially those laid out in a similar manner, the central building was the chapel. At the University of Virginia, however, the central rotunda, patterned after Rome's Pantheon, became the school's center of learning, the library in the dome room, with bookshelves on a radius behind the columns. Behind these columns on the radius were the bookshelves. And you know probably Jefferson's thoughts on religion. He was very adamant about religion and the separation of religion and schools and different things of that sort. He was basically a Unitarian, and he thought that Unitarianism would actually take over the world. He was a little bit wrong about that, but he did believe that very strongly. Next. The rotundas, then, double-curved wall spaces on the two lower levels were the first such, what we call CYMA, C-Y-M-A, double spaces, seen in the United States. The very first time anyone witnessed this double curved space on a wall. Very unique. Next. Now, we'll go on then to federal houses. Next. Perhaps the first classical portico house in Virginia is the Archibald Stewart House in Stanton, built in 1791. It is still in the same family to this day. It has this magnificent original Chinese Chippendale style gate, but with many provincial details in the house itself, such as the steep portico roof, in which there are double hung windows rather than the circular lunette. How many have been to this building? No one. You can see it from the street if you walk around Stanton. Stanton is one of the most extraordinary towns around. Always my first class, when I had my year-long classes, always my first tour was of Stanton. You can see more things in Stanton architecturally than any place around here. It's extraordinary. Next. And here you see then Flemish Bond, every third brick there forms sort of a plus sign. Above and below what's called the water table, which has a double curved water table here, made of bricks, special bricks. Next. I should have said that. Good evening, Jenny. These walls are paper thin. Wow. Okay, now some houses specially designed by Jefferson. Of course, next. We have Monticello next. Jefferson's Monticello began in 1768 when he was but 25 years of age as a tripartite design as shown in the top illustration. One, two, three parts. Okay. But while minister to France, Jefferson observed the building of the Hotel de Somme across from the Louvre in Paris. He said that I am, quote, violently smitten with the Hotel de Somme and used to go to the Tuileries almost daily to look at it. Unquote. He came back and introduced the dome and doubled the size of the house as seen in the bottom illustration that you see today. As he said, quote, architecture is my delight and putting up and pulling down one of my favorite amusements, unquote. He got in a lot of trouble financially about that. Next. The decision to build on top of a mountain was unique in America, resulting in below-grade passages and separate outbuildings derived from the Roman villa. It is the first figural, or non-orthogonal or non-rectangular space in America, with none of its interior spaces alike, just like at the pavilions. None of those first floor spaces are alike. The stairs are pulled off to the side, and the entrance corridor is no longer continuous through the house, but one enters a receiving space behind which is a private salon or drawing room, resulting in a greater separation of public and private. Okay? But this part here, there's no two spaces really alike in there. Next. It was the first dome built on an American house visible from the exterior. There were some built that were enclosed, but this is the first one visible from the exterior. Next. The full entablature, an entablature is this part up here. It's made up of three parts, an entablature. The top part is called the, anybody know? My students should, is the cornice. The middle is called the frieze. And the bottom part is called the architrave. That is a full entablature, three parts, okay? The full entablature above the second floor windows at floor level, like the Roman half floor in the Hotel de Somme, lowered the exterior scale. And also, there were windows here then in the entablature in the metopes between the triglyphs to light the upper floor. You see these little, I don't know if you can see them or not, in between those windows are vertical lines. They're called triglyphs, and the spaces between them are called the metopes in architectural terms. And that, so he used those and made glass in them to light another floor level, because there's several floors, of course, as you know, in Monticello. Okay, next. This then is the Hotel de Somme, which Jefferson had so admired. Its bust niches became windows at Monticello, mainly because Jefferson felt that a young nation could only handle one art at a time, and he chose architecture. Next. The rear courtyard of the Hotel de Somme might have influenced the colonnade of the UVA lawn. Next. This section from James Gibbs' Book of Architecture of 1728 probably influenced Monticello's dome section. Next. Jefferson was also a master of illusion. as shown in this telephoto view that I took of the balustrade, which becomes two-dimensional when it goes along the brick wall right here. So the next time you go out there and look at that, look at it more carefully. It's an illusion. Next. It's Lazy Susan door to the dining room is where the outside servant, of course, placed food on the shelves and turned it, the door, to the inside servant. Next. The use of triple-hung windows provides two things, really, that a triple-hung window can do. It's very unique. One is that it gives great air circulation when the bottom sash is pulled to the middle and the top sash is pulled to the middle, and you get great air circulation. The other advantage is, like at the lawn, if you raise up the two bottom ones to the top, you can walk out of doors. Okay? So it also formed a door, too, a doorway. Next. The second floor windows, then, at floor level, and you can go to the second floor now at Monticello, if they've opened it up. The second floor windows at floor level, in order to get under this great full exterior entablature. See, the entablature on the outside goes all the way down to here on the exterior. So this window is at floor level. And what's nice about those windows is if you sit in a chair in there or on the bed, you can look directly out. It's wonderful. Yeah, of course, it was probably not intended. The intention was to bring the scale down by the big entablature outside. But it's a wonderful thing that has happened. Next. The first use in America of double glazing in the windows and doors of the dining room alleviate the cold weather winds from the northwest. Next. And the small stairwells have skylights above, and you can't see it here, but Jefferson's favorite motif on the side of the stairs was a tulip bud, and that was a favorite of his, which is on these. Next. Jefferson's bed then straddled a space between the study and dressing room, as you well know, with a closet above and his interior privy nearby. The triple-hung windows have solid shutters on the inside that close into the wall. This little closet up here has caused a lot of speculation, unjustly so. Especially with that Sally Hemings case, which is perfectly ridiculous. But anyway, it was a storage room. Okay. Next. His bed chambers, then, in other rooms, have recessed beds in the French manner, and then double doors. You see a door here, and then you see another door there. Double doors for acoustic purposes. I know all of you notice this when you're walking around Monticello. You've noticed all this, right? Next. The magnificent dome room was little used, but had utilized a wooden DeLorme truss, as the university had done to support its roof, a very unique system of wood trusses. Next. In the dome room, then, its gigantic mannerist baseboard displays both cyma recta and cyma reversa, these double curves, again, like those walls are, that Jefferson used over and over again, and you see this constantly in the federal period, these double curves. The reason for this gigantic baseboard, I think, is because it was originally designed for a taller space, because the space in the first one was going to be two stories high, and this is the way this comes about, I'm pretty sure. Rick is going to correct me on that.
Oh, no. I'm anxious to hear that, because I'm very confused about why it would be so high.
I know.
Up in the
That's right. Well, the reason I'm pretty sure is it was designed for the larger space before they came back and redid it. That's Ed Lay's theory, which of course is always correct. Next. Oh, wait.
Did you
want
to go back?
No, next. Okay, that's it. Now, the space boards then, when you walk out on the terrace at Monticello or at the university, those terraces above the little Tuscan columns at the university, are made such that, I think I mentioned this, if you walk up here, see on the board at the top, there's little spaces between the boards. If you remember Monticello when you walk out on the terrace, right, there's little spaces between those boards. That's so the water goes down and goes into these little metal-lined troughs down to a little gutter here, and the gutter then went to a larger gutter, and from then the rainwater went to cisterns, both at the university and at Monticello. Next. And here is a piece, the only piece left of the one at the university. Nobody at the university seems to know what this is. It's been hanging on the wall for years. But what it is, this is the little trough thing. It was taken off the university in probably in the 1920s or 30s, and this is the only piece left. And you can see here where the troughs were. See, there were boards across the top, and so on. Okay. Next. And then when these little troughs go through at Monticello, go through the under passage, and there's a house above, then he put in bricks for insulation and sort of somewhat soundproofing. Okay, next. Aha. This is important. Okay. Now, Jefferson at Monticello, Monticello contained three interior privies, or necessary houses. This one here also shows, by the way, Jefferson's design for the first fire extinguisher in America. But at any rate, this privy is the one off of Jefferson's master bedroom. There's a little passage you go through between the bed and the room, and it's right in there. How many have seen this? Oh, a couple people. Okay, good. It's usually not open to the public. Next. And then it has this little privy, has this wonderful tall space going up to a skylight. What a wonderful throne room. Isn't this fantastic? At any rate, Monticello should remove those pipes, leave that door open, because it is a masterwork of Jefferson and it should be seen by the public. And I've told the last director, and I will tell the next director when I get a chance to. But nobody listens to me. But they got to remove those pipes and all. That's a big problem. Next. Okay. And then, as you well know, they brought ice up from the river or ponds below and put it in to the Monticello underpassage, with straw between and all, and it has earth on top for insulation, for an ice house. Next. This reconstructed garden pavilion overlooks the garden parterres or terraces with the higher mountain in the background, now owned by Monticello, where Jefferson had envisioned a ziggurat building, a building with little steps in it, like the step pyramid, with water pummeling from below out of this thing. Had it been built, it would have been our first Disney World attraction. Also, the tallest building Jefferson ever designed. And Monticello has now purchased this, and as I've told the last president of Monticello, Dan Jordan, he's obligated now, since he owns that, to construct that tower. Can you imagine how much that would cost? At the time of his death, then, Jefferson was in debt $105,000, about $2 million in today's terms. Ironically, Levy, who saved Monticello, was in debt at the same time of his death, about $1 million. Monticello's really made paupers out of his custodians, unfortunately. Yeah. Next. Okay. In 1802, then, Jefferson designed an octagonal addition to an earlier farmhouse in the county, Farmington, owned by his another friend, George Divers. Next. But during its construction, is there one before that?
Yeah,
sorry. I'm sorry. But during its construction, where was Jefferson at the time? This is 1803. Yes, he was President of the United States then from 1801 to 1809. And upon his return, he was really disappointed with its execution. I think all of you can see that, I mean, anybody can see that the columns are really out of proportion with the height. It's very too slender. And what about its entablature? What about its entablature? Look what happens. The full entablature, only the cornice goes around the demi-octagonal ends, and the frieze and architrave are left behind. Okay. Next. As you know, in 1927, it became one of Virginia's most prestigious country clubs. And typical of Jefferson, its interior of Farmington was originally asymmetrical. He did not do things symmetrically. With offset partition, we even have his drawings, with a loft space above, and it contained griffins and other Roman designs in its entablature, which were removed in 1929, unfortunately. Next. I only have till 9 o'clock, don't I? No. You want me over here at 7, right? Is that right? I might, if I go a little beyond,
oh,
okay.
You're fine.
You can cut me off here.
You're fine.
I ad-lib too much, I guess. Now to review some houses patterned after Andrea Palladio's Villa Capra or Rotunda in Vicenza, Italy. Andrea Palladio, Jefferson was very fond of him. He was born in 1508 and died in 1580. And incidentally, my friend and colleague, Mario de Valmarano, you may have heard of him, he owned the Villa Capra or Villa Rotunda, which many of these are patterned after. He just died last week. Next. In 1804, Jefferson envisioned an octagonal home in combination with rectangular spaces for his daughter Maria, wife of John Epps, and leveled the site east of Charlottesville at Pantops to accommodate it. The house was never built because Maria died that year. This is at Pantops it was going to be built. But 2 years later, he began a similar dwelling on land inherited by his late wife from her family. It was 90 miles away from Monticello on a farm in Bedford County and was designed to be a country retreat. His granddaughter, Cornelia Randolph, wrote that they had at least 50 persons to dinner in a week at Monticello. So I guess he did need a retreat. Poplar Forest, by the way, it's hard to find even today if you ever go to Poplar Forest. How many have been to Poplar Forest?
It is hard to find.
It is hard to find, but it's a wonderful, it's far more interesting architecturally, by the way, than Monticello. Perfect answer. Poplar Forest features a rear facade. Did you take them on a trip there or something? They all put up their hand. Oh, okay. Poplar Forest features a rear facade that demonstrates the very first use of a portico over an arcade. A portico over an arcade. Okay? What was the second time Jefferson used that motif? You just saw it earlier.
One of the pavilions at the university?
Yeah. Pavilion, the Colonnade Club at the university. Okay? And that particular pavilion was the second, it was the other time that he used that. Pavilion 7, yeah, now the Colonnade Club, yeah. Poplar Forest, then, interior burned in 1845. Our students are the one that run all of this, by the way, just like at Montpelier, the same way. Our students in architecture are the ones involved with all these. In Colonial Williamsburg, they're all from, most of them are from UVA. Next. There are earth mounds planted in the Poplar Forest, planted in the neoclassical manner, with weeping willows on either side of a bowling green, and beyond, on axis with the house proper, are the octagonal necessary houses or privies. Next. Jefferson patterned Poplar Forest, the first octagonal house built in America, after a plate in William Kent's Designs of Inigo Jones of 1727. It's a perfect cube in the interior, with chimneys that form the diagonals form the chimneys, and then in turn form the octagonal spaces. It's a very, very sophisticated design. You will also note, and you already have, these are where the beds were. So you can get out of one side and the other, just like at Monticello. And the grid paper drawing was long believed to be by Jefferson's granddaughter, who was an artist, Cornelia. But I think that we've proved now this is really by John Nielsen, Jefferson's most famous master builder from Ulster. Next. He also laid out the grounds at Poplar Forest with geometric precision, as in this theoretical site plan, which is now proving to be very accurate through archaeological investigation. So here's the original house. All of this is laid out with great precision of proportional systems. All the landscape. Next. Jefferson patterned several of his buildings after the 16th century architect that I mentioned, Andrea Palladio, and he said that, quote, Palladio is the Bible, unquote, and had five versions of Palladio's Quattro Libri, his four books of architecture, one of which was a pocket version that he loaned out to others and said, you know, get this and do it this way. Next. The 1796 Edgemont, shown here, for James Powell Cock in Albemarle County, is patterned after Palladio's Villa Capra or Rotunda in Vicenza, Italy. It has five parterres on the land, meaning five terraces. In 1936, the early woman photographer, Frances Benjamin Johnston, and architect Milton Grigg rediscovered this house. It was in ruins. It had simply a two-story demi-octagonal end on the north, but Grigg squared it off with an arcade below, just like Jefferson, other things, and columns above, and added two pavilions, I guess you can't see them off in the distance, and an underground passage with lunettes. You can't see it, unfortunately. As I noted in an Architectural Digest article a couple years ago, in many ways, this building, Edgemont, is really a masterpiece of the hands of the great architect, local architect, Milton Grigg, even more so than Jefferson, who was the original designer. Next. Another house patterned after the Villa Capra is Folly in Augusta County, just over the mountain, built in 1818, for Joseph Smith, and is still in the family to this day. Next. Here you see tripartite, three windows, tripartite window groupings, a favorite of La Trobe, which became popular after 1810. The gardens here are enclosed with serpentine walls, the only early 19th century example remaining in the state of serpentine walls. The ones here at the university have been rebuilt at least twice now that I know. Next. Here you will note at Folly the pie-shaped bricks used at the university and elsewhere. You can see them because the stucco isn't on them right now. And they're done with special molded bricks, and for not only those, but also the bases and the capitals. Next. And these are the original molds for those that the family owns. These are the brick molds for the big brick, and these are for the pie-shaped bricks, for instance. Next. And here are some of the many bricks that were made from these little things. You can see all the different configurations. So you can imagine how many brick molds have to be made to do all of these things, to make all of that happen. Next. Several houses were built in the tripartite or temple form, like the first Monticello. Next, the Finney House. Next. The first one of these, three bay, meaning three openings across the facade, three bay, two-story center pavilions with lower side wing houses. The very first one of these that we know of is the Finney or Semple House, S-E-M-P-L-E, of 1778 in Williamsburg. How many have seen this? You usually don't see it on a tour of Williamsburg other than, but it's really one of the buildings to see there. It's so important, okay? It's right on the edge of the historic district. Next. Its pattern, this house's pattern book source could be from Robert Morris's Select Architecture 1751, the lower one here, or William Halfpenny's Useful Architecture of 1752. I'm just seeing if you can read backwards. In 1833, then, Menard Lefevre's Modern Builder's Guide popularized this house form, but with square portico columns, and it became popular all up and down the East Coast. And Jefferson's master builders used it over and over again in their own work. Next. As I mentioned, the earliest brick tripartite house in Albemarle County was the first Monticello, while the earliest unaltered extant example is this one, Mountain Grove, built in this county for Revolutionary War Captain Benjamin Harris in 1803. Next. It has stuccoed jack arches. You can see them here because some of the stucco is falling off. Stuccoed jack arches to resemble stone over the doors and windows. This is typical of this federal period. The front elevation has molded brick water tables, 9/9 sash with 9/6 above. That gives the illusion of greater height, by the way, like many of the Williamsburg houses do. And then it has this bullseye window here in what's called a tympanum, this triangular space. And then wooden scrolled medallions, not dentils, these are big scrolled medallions, around the roof eaves. Next. Its double-leaf front door features a flat transom with intricate glass above. Next. As shown in this measured drawing, which we did for the Historic American Building Survey, which is now in the Library of Congress, the proportions of Mountain Grove's facade, plan, and landscape are all based on what is called the golden section. Everything is always done on proportional systems. Even the most humble little log buildings were done on a proportional system. That's a whole other course in itself. The proportions of Mountain Grove's facade, plan, and landscape are all based on this golden section with 248-foot square plantation quadrangles. Next. Its plan then shows its three single pile spaces. One, two, three. Okay. Next. Which allow then great cross ventilation and light into all the rooms. It's a wonderful one. No wonder it became so popular. Very, very popular plan. Very livable. Very light and airy. Next. Mountain Grove is really an exquisitely proportioned and detailed building, And a friend of mine purchased this building a few years ago and is restoring it and doing a beautiful job, by the way, not the way that you see right now that I showed you. That's before her restoration. Has anyone seen this house? My students in the class should have. Okay, next. Okay. It's 7 o'clock. Okay. After the death of Dabney Carr, his wife, Jefferson's sister, moved the family into Monticello, where the oldest son, Peter, age 3, was reared and educated under the influence of his famous uncle. Later, he studied under George Wythe at the College of William & Mary, as Jefferson had done. Next. Carsbrook, shown here, had been built north of Charlottesville in the 1780s by his grandfather, Thomas Carr, and was sold to William Carey Nicholas, who became governor of Virginia, who was Peter Carr's father-in-law. So it's very interconnected. And then he inherited the house, Dabney Carr, in 1798. Carr served as Jefferson's personal secretary and ran a private school here until his early death in 1815. Carsbrook's three-bay, you know what a bay is now, three-bay, two-story center pavilion has a rear passage behind here, rear passage to its pavilion wings, thus creating a five-part composition. One, two, three, inside there, and then five. How many have seen Carsbrook? This is right on, it's right in Carsbrook. Can't miss it. It's right on the corner. Right on the corner. It was a bed and breakfast for a short while. I don't know whether it still is or not. Can't miss it. Okay. Next. Now, Mirador. Another variation of the tripartite house is the 1832 Mirador in Alamar County. Next. Which exhibits a center pavilion turned sideways with lower side wings. Interestingly, at the turn of the 20th century, it became the home of the Langern sisters. Who knows who they were? Oh, okay. Everybody's smart in here. Of course, Nancy Langern, who became Lady Astor, the first woman of British Parliament, and Irene, who became known as the Gibson Girl, the figure for artist Charles Dana Gibson's magazine portraits. Next. Some other federal dwelling examples. Next. Another house prototype in this period is a demi-octagonal ended house portrayed here by point of honor for Dr. George Cabell in 1815 in Lynchburg. How many have seen this? A couple. Okay. Lynchburg is another great city to visit, and they have great walking tours too, and just rich with architecture. It contains some of the finest interior details from another pattern book. Next. Okay. Monticello, though the first house with figural space in the county, was not the last. Redlands, as you see here, was another. Martin Thacker built Redlands for Robert Carter, great-grandson of Robert King Carter, who, as you probably know, was the richest and most powerful man of his generation. Okay? It remains in the Carter family to this day and contains a remarkable assemblage of portraits, furniture, and other family possessions reflecting their long tenure. I assume most of you have seen this house. How many have not seen it? Ooh. Okay. Wow, okay. This is a prize of a house. Early in the 20th century then, Baltimore architect Howard Seal renovated the brick house and completed the interior of the second floor. Okay. And he worked for the great architect, by the way, John Russell Pope, who designed, for instance, the National Gallery in D.C. and so on. But he worked on this building. Next. So the exterior you just saw was very Georgian looking, just a flat facade, right? But look what happens. It gives away its federal features. Its bowels are protruding. That's the figural space. The figural space coming into play now, not orthogonal spaces. Alexander Parrish executed a similar projecting federal segmental salon in the Wickham Valentine House in Richmond in 1812. Projecting segmental spaces were illustrated in John Soane's Plans, Elevations, and Sections of Buildings in 1788. So this is 1789. It's very modern. Most people, I want to tell you, were doing very modern things. They were not copying details like builders do today. And Jefferson was not copying things much either, by the way. Maybe that's another whole subject. He was a modernist, and today we are somehow or another misled by the fact that we should repeat doing these things, and it's usually done pretty badly, unfortunately. Next. That's my little lecture for the day. Its name is derived from the red clay soil. The house was built on the southeastern side of Carter's Mountain, commanding the crest of a knoll amid large trees and with splendid views of the mountains to the northwest. Isn't this fantastic? To the east were boxwood-lined flower and vegetable gardens containing 12 squares. Some were laid out in the form of a Maltese cross, a reflection of Robert Carter's Masonic affiliation. A lot of these people were Masons, and the Masonic order came into play in not only their gardens, but houses and all sorts of things. There's evidence of that. Next. Redlands, this is a plan of Redlands. Redlands contains 17 rooms with 12 fireplaces that open into just two chimney stacks. And that's a problem with the house, unfortunately. The interior contains a bed alcove, a dumbwaiter, right here, dumbwaiter to transport food from the cellar kitchen to the first floor dining room, and a shaft, right in here, and a shaft paralleling the stairwell from the second floor that probably was used to convey chamber pots to the cellar. Next. The attic construction consists of these massive, very massive king post trusses, and its first floor, down in here, first floor utilizes corn shucks for insulation. Buildings had a lot of different ways of insulating things, with clay, with bricks, and this one with corn shucks. Okay. Next. East Belmont, then, near Keswick, was built for John Rogers Sr. in 1811. Rogers, the first cousin of explorer George Rogers Clark, served as overseer at Monticello while Jefferson was in France. In 1825, his son, John Rogers Jr., added this brick eye house with a fan-like doorway by a black brick basin, Lewis Level. The two-tiered portico, featuring square columns and Chinese railings, became a ubiquitous feature in many houses all throughout Virginia and up and down the East Coast. In 2004, this was listed for $19.5 million. I know one of you probably bought this, right? Next. Now to show you, we're going to end with a few details, federal details. Next. Federal details. Elaborate plaster medallions came into vogue in this period, such as, such as this one in the 1804 Oatlands in Loudoun County. How many have been to Oatlands? It's open to the public if you're a National Trust member. And all of your national, should be National Trust members. It's a very worthy cause. Next. Or like this one in the 1828 Astuteville in Albemarle County, taken from an 1806 Asher Benjamin pattern book. Next. The federal mantle featured delicate details, very delicate. Here in the 1827 Livers townhouse in Charlottesville, The mantle exhibits an attenuated mantle shelf with cutout top, patera, and sunburst in the frieze, included colonnettes with ionic caps. In other words, the way you tell a federal mantle is, first of all, it's built out in layers to make it look thinner on the edge. That's called attenuation. Okay, and if you look down on the top of it, it's cut out. Part of the mantle shelf is cut out. Okay, and it often has what we call patera or sunbursts in it, and colonnettes. After this period is called the Greek Revival period, after this federal period, that's when you get real clunky, heavy, thick mantle shells. No attenuation. Okay. Next. This 1798 Redlands mantle shows also, often used, the adamesque details, such as swags, see the swags, and lidded urns. Next. Ornate graining and marbleizing of wood were featured in this period. This is wood. This wooden mantle in the main salon of the 1803 Mountain Grove boasts this herringbone latticework, garland, stippling, marbleizing, and graining based on another pattern book. Next. Often the owner's initials and construction date were incised into a wet brick and after drying were penciled, here represented by Jesse Garth, 1805. What preserved this brick was an addition to the house over the exterior, what was the exterior chimney. Often too, in this period, over the entire brickwork, over the entire brickwork's mortar was penciled with a white lime stripe to make the brick appear more even, as seen here. See, the very bright. If we did that today, it would look like a cartoon. But it was done quite often in those days. Okay. And this lasted up into the Victorian period, by the way, penciling. You'll see this at the university. If you walk around, you can still see the penciling on the brick fading. Unfortunately, this Albemarle County house was demolished in 1997. Next, the asymmetrical molding with sima curves was common in the federal period, as I told you. If you can envision this, this is a quick sketch I did. This is looking down on top of, if you cut a cut through a doorway and wall and look down upon it, this is the wall, and here's where the door was, okay? And this side is a molding, and this side is a molding. And here you see these double curves, these sima curves, okay? Very typical of this period. These change radically in the next period, which we're not talking about, the Greek Revival period. They become symmetrical moldings, not asymmetrical ones, okay? Next. And now we'll end with this little picture. A pragmatic feature from India, shown here in Tallwood in Albemarle County, was the punkah, P-U-N-K-A-H. What was its purpose?
It's a fan.
Fan, yes. It was a fan to fan the dining table to cool the air and deter flies. Believe it or not, this is from about a 1940 picture. 1940. In Look magazine. And it shows, let me tell you how it works. See this wonderful fan here, classical fan from India? That still exists, by the way, that fan. I found where it is. And there's a big rod up here. It's attached to it. It goes through the wall and out the other side, and there's a T on the other side. And the young man here is pulling that little T and fanning the roof. Okay? I found so many of the hooks left, but not the fans, in many of these buildings. These little hooks are still up there to hold it up. Okay. Next, I think that's it. Yes. Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.